With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. It's Sunday, which means it's Mother's Day for our mums all around the world. And I hope that you've been able to spoil her today and honour all of those who gave us life. What a wonderful time to acknowledge everyone's mums. Happy Mother's Day to you and yours. Now, today, this hour, we're going to return to Australia. And in a moment, I'll have Mark Hendricks joining me. Mark is a geologist. He's a blogger and an author. And in 2007, he started a PhD project at Macquarie University looking at the relationship between natural occurrences of asbestos and mesothelioma in South and Eastern Australia. His first foray into blogging was in 2009 with a blog called ABC Newswatch. The blog focused on fact-checking ABC news stories, particularly relating to ABC's biased climate change coverage, sending in complaints and publishing the results. The blog scored 33 upheld complaints and contributed to ABC altering its complaint handling process. A number of feature articles from the blog relating to ABC's biased news were published in the Australian newspaper. Then he started his Right to Climb blog, which is righttoclimb.blogspot.com, in 2017. When the permanent closure of the Ayers Rock Climb was announced, that being at Uluru, for those who don't remember, that used to be called Ayers Rock, he's been a regular contributor to Quadrant Magazine and The Spectator Australia. He's the author of a number of satirical books on climate change and also to guides to climbing Ayers Rock and Mount Warning. And it's that part there of Mount Warning that's particularly interesting, because Mark appeared on the show recently and was in the process of organising, or had already started, a petition because Mount Warning in New South Wales was also being closed to climbers. And if the petition reached 10,000, it would automatically trigger a debate in New South Wales Parliament. And that debate happened last Thursday. So Mark's here and will join me in just a moment. Mark Hendricks, welcome back to TNT.
Hi, Jason. Good to hear from you again.
Terrific. Also to have you back on the show, and delighted that you've been able to achieve the result of the petition to get the 10,000 signatures and therefore trigger the debate. Can you explain how that is a process in the first instance, why it's 10,000 that gets the interest that Parliament must go through with this process?
Sure, yeah. So the New South Wales Upper Chamber, the Legislative Council, have a process where the general public can put forward a petition. They need to get that petition sponsored by one of the members of Parliament. So luckily we had John Ruddock. And in fact, it was actually John Ruddock who kicked this off this time. So he approached us and said, look, we want to get a petition up and running. And I need someone to... So you need two things. One is a sponsor. And John Ruddock, a Libertarian MLC in the Upper House, was our sponsor. And I put the petition forward as a member of the public. In terms of the numbers, so e-petition, so there's two, it's really, really strange. It's one of these sort of crazy bureaucratic things that, you know, happens with government. So e-petitions actually require 20,000 signatures, but John managed to get an agreement with the Minister Penny Sharp to reduce that number to 10,000, which was good. She said, if you get 10,000 on the e-petition, then I'll agree to a debate to go ahead. So that was back in... After we did the Australia Day climb in January, John approached us then, so we had about 3 months to get those numbers up. The petition closed on the 2nd of May. In the week before, we actually made that 10K mark, and then Penny Sharp, the minister, agreed that the petition could go, the debate could go ahead. So that was, it was sort of, because normally you need 20,000. You need 10,000 written signatures. So they still do something, you know, with written signatures. So if you go around the neighbourhood with a bit of paper or a clipboard and you get people to sign your petition, if you get 10,000 written signatures, that counts to trigger this debate. But Penny Sharp agreed that 10,000 e-signatures would be sufficient to get this going.
It's certainly a little bit more generous than we've come to expect from a divided parliament. So that is wonderful news and well negotiated to John Ruddick from the Libertarians, who appears regularly Absolutely. On TNT. So that's a big deal from John, Mark. So you achieved the results, and it's still a process, and that process was fairly quick, though, to get it into parliament already last week.
Yeah, so the close of the petition was on the 2nd of May. I think the parliamentary clerks look over the numbers and make sure that everything's correct. So one of the limitations about the New South Wales parliamentary petition system is that it's only available to members or to residents of New South Wales. So while we were trying to get the numbers up and running, we had a lot of people from southeast Queensland, because Mount Warning is really close to the Queensland border. And it attracts probably a larger proportion of Queensland residents climb the mountain than they do in New South Wales. So there was a lot of frustration from people who couldn't sign it. And, you know, partly to do with, you know, we call these things national parks. You know, there's Mount Warning National Park, there's Mount Ku'ring'ai Chase National Park, but in fact, they're actually state parks, right? They're managed by the state. And when it comes to Australians having a say about them, if you don't live in the state, well, you can forget about having any say about how your national park's being managed. It's just one of these quirky things about the way they name these things. Yeah, national park, but you know, people in Queensland can't have a say in what's going on in a national park. It's just a bit crazy.
Extraordinary. I'm wondering if that even was something that came up in Parliament. Well, just before we get into to what happened on Thursday, if you can just explain to our viewers and listeners, what was the reason behind Mount Warning's closure in the first place?
So Mount Warning was declared a national park back in 1929. The track to the summit was built in 1909 by volunteers from Mooloomba. The Mooloomba is the closest major town to Mount Warning, and they saw the mountain as a major tourist potential to increase the local economy. So they had a bunch of volunteers go up there, and they constructed this beautiful track to the summit back in 1909. 1929, on the 3rd of August, it was declared a national park. Leap forward all the way through, you know, so that the people came in their droves to visit the summit. It's just one of the most beautiful views in New South Wales, the views from the summit. You know, you can see all the way down to Cape Byron, the lighthouse down there, all the way up to the Gold Coast. The surrounding volcanic caldera structure is just absolutely outstanding. Tourist numbers gradually increased. In the 1980s, National Parks and Wildlife Service recognised that there were some issues at the summit, so they built these four beautiful lookouts. There's one at each of the cardinal points, north, south, east and west of the summit, and they improved access along the last sort of 200 metres or so at Mount Warning, which is a little bit of a rock scramble, so they put a chain in place just to make it easier for people to climb. No problems with people climbing, right? No, right up until 1999. When National Parks had organised what they called the Millennium Walk. So one of the other things about Mount Warning is it's the first place on the Australian mainland to see the sunrise each day for most of the year. And they recognised that there would be a rush of tourists visiting the summit at that Millennium event. And they organised a ballot of 60 tickets, so they limited numbers to 60 people, and they organised this ballot where people could put their name in a hat and have it drawn out. And it was going really well, right up until the last minute. So pretty much on the 30th of December, an Aboriginal man from Grafton, outside the area, you can't even see Mount Warning from Grafton, put his hand up and said, look, I don't want people to climb it, it's sacred, it's a men's initiation site. At the time, those claims were dumped on by other Aboriginal elders around the place. So we had his actual cousin, I think, a man called Fletcher Roberts, called his claims a modern day invention. You know, there's nothing wrong with people climbing the summit, and that event went ahead. But somehow his views became ingrained in National Parks and Wildlife policy in New South Wales. And shortly afterwards, in the early 2000s, National Parks erected a sign at the base saying that the Bundjalung elders don't want you to climb the mountain. And they've been working since then as an active policy to close that summit track to the public. And it wasn't until there's a couple of things in there that they tried as well. They tried this demarketing campaign with hundreds of thousands of dollars spent through Southern Cross University to demarket this national treasure. Can you believe it? They got their opportunity to close it in association with COVID. So March 2020, they said it's unsafe to climb the track because when you touch that chain at the summit, you might catch COVID from someone else. and they instituted a... John had a great line in Parliament. I'll probably talk about it, but, you know, you can't catch COVID from a leaf, you know, how ridiculous that was. So 6 months into that, so mid-2020, other national parks across the state started opening, but Mount Warning remained closed. And I got involved with trying to, well, why is this one closed and the others are open? And suddenly it became about safety. So the chain that I mentioned at the summit was no longer safe, apparently. And that was why they were keeping it closed. And so we had this rolling period of 6 months closes that went into 2022. In October 2022, National Parks announced an Aboriginal Place Management Plan had been developed. And as part of that plan, the public were to be banned from the summit because they weren't the right race, they weren't the right ideology, they weren't the right sex. So the summit climb was going to be okay for what they called initiated men, male elders, particular of the Bundjalung group. Everyone else was excluded. And they actually erected a fence across the entrance to the track to try and keep people out. So that's sort of a really brief snapshot of where Mount Warning, how it got closed. It was really closed based on a mistake. So National Parks believed this person who had a very contemporary, modern-day version of Aboriginal mythology, which had no basis in previous anthropological research, and they took that forward, and they've basically promoted and promulgated that view for 20 years. So unfortunately, now you've got Aboriginal kids who have been inculcated in that fake story, and they believe it as well. At the same time, we've got another Aboriginal group up there, the Ngarrakwal people, who are happy for people to climb. In fact, they actually encourage people to climb the summit to view creation. So it doesn't really make any sense. But National Parks at the moment trying very hard, I think, to correct an error without losing face. But in reality, I believe someone really needs to get their ass kicked and needs to be sacked over it, you know?
Absolutely. So when you've got competing Aboriginal nations or tribes, one saying, no, you can't come here, and yes, you can, what happens just within the Aboriginal community, therefore, to come to some sort of consensus? Or is that something that's not allowed to be spoken of either?
In my experience, I've worked with Aboriginal groups in Central Australia, where you've got any sort of conflicting views, it's very hard to get any sort of consensus between different groups. The same sort of situation happened with Ayers Rock too, the closure of Ayers Rock. So there you had a group of older men who had been born in the area, who had been gone through the men's initiation process at the Rock. They lived into their 70s. After they died in the mid-80s, a new group came in from South Australia with a different view. The old blokes were really quite indifferent to the public climbing the Rock. In fact, one of them was actually a tour guide who led tourists to the summit. So the older group had no real major issues with people climbing, but this new group coming in from mainly from South Australia did. And I think they were helped along the way with Parks Australia in terms of their view. So they were quite risk averse. They didn't want people to climb because they saw it as a big safety issue. And they, in a way, used the Aboriginal community to get their goal. And I think National Parks and Wildlife Service have also used this Aboriginal group who want the Mount Warning Summit closed for their own ends, because they see it as a little bit of a problem. It's a park that really deserves much more maintenance attention. The track, you know, there's a lot of rainfall in that area, so it really needs a lot more maintenance that National Parks have given it over the years. And if they could strike it off their books and don't have to worry about it anymore, well, that makes life easier for them. So getting any sort of consensus amongst Aboriginal groups who have very strong black and white views about things is almost impossible in my experience.
It just seems like such a waste, doesn't it, that you have a rock as old as time itself, a mountain that is only accessible to a selected part of the community in an age where diversity, equity, inclusion is the, you know, de jure. That's what we're meant to believe in. And at the same time, no, but we're the ones that are allowed to exclude, as if it's some type of punishment, Mark.
Look, the people who want to climb are the racists, you know. We're there saying, look, we support the opinions of this Ngarrakwal group of people who want the mountain open for everyone. We want the mountain open for everyone. But somehow we are the racists. We are the ones that are somehow excluding other groups from being able to enjoy the mountain the way that they see it to be enjoyed, which is essentially, I think, they want it to be left alone. And that's one opinion. And someone sort of who supports, you know, freedom of ideas and freedom of speech, well, that's one view, but don't impose it's your view on everyone else, you know. It's really abhorrent that people want to really inflict that sort of, if you don't want to experience the joy and wonder of the summit and you don't want your children to experience it, that's fine. But we want to do that. You know, we want to experience that exhilarating experience and look at those views and get in touch with that natural environment so we can, you know, teach our kids about it and they can preserve it for their kids and grandkids. You know, if we leave these things alone and lock them up, one, we've got a huge problem with feral animals at the moment in national parks, pigs and deer and other things that are destroying sort of local habitats. We've got problems in that park with cane toads. We've got problems in that park with weeds. You know, if you leave it alone, it's not going to manage itself that well. So, you know, the weeds, cane toads, the things you want to get rid of, and if you leave it alone, they're just going to explode in numbers. The other problem up there is, of course, fires as well. So we get a good, we've had a wet season now for quite a few years. We get a dry season in there, and those tracks provide important access for firefighters to go in and perhaps put a spot fire out or something like that. And if they're not there anymore, well, the park and its neighbouring properties are at greater risk. So there's a whole host of factors that go in there. It means, you know, these things really need to be kept open and preserved for everyone.
Yes, indeed. Now, you've certainly painted a picture that many of us wouldn't understand detail and nuance as you have. So what we're going to do is we'll take our first break and then we're going to return. Mark will deliver what happened on Thursday in New South Wales Parliament in this particular debate organised, firstly through John Ruddock, MLC, and this is democracy in action, if you will. You don't want to go anywhere. In the meantime, if you love a good documentary, then you'll love our special screenings, Uninterrupted Cinema, features some of the latest or notable documentaries from the world's best filmmakers. You can check out TNT's website for more information. Weekends are better when you spend it with us on today's News Talk. TNT.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Royd.
The longer it takes for a company to do disaster recovery and get back to business, the longer it takes for their customers to be back in contact with, you know, the products and services they're using from the businesses that you're protecting. So, I mean, it's sort of a domino effect. It's not just the company, but all of that company's customers. And these days in the modern era, I mean, as they say for the young people, instant gratification isn't instant enough. I mean, we want disaster recovery to happen in minutes, if not hours, like at the most. And in the past, it could have taken days.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And in fact, where I'm coming to you from Western Canada, our biggest pharmacy chain here had a ransomware attack 4 or 5 days ago, and their stores have literally been closed now for going on day 6, where nobody's able to get prescriptions. Like, can you imagine not being able to fill your prescriptions because of a cyber attack? I mean, it's devastating, not just to the business and the people who are financially impacted there, but just to our community in general.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royd on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour is geologist, blogger, author, mountain climber, Mark Hendricks. And Marcus, filled us in on the detail of the closure of Mount Warning National Park in New South Wales that has led to a petition to be heard in state parliament. And the magic number of 10,000 signatures or e-signatures was achieved. And this resulted in the parliamentary debate happening Thursday. So, Mark, what happened?
Well, it's a very interesting day that we had down there. Debate, yeah, interesting word, isn't it? You know, if you look at the definition, I don't think they've quite got the idea of what it should be in the state parliament house. So the debate was scheduled for the 9th of May, Thursday the 9th of May, and John Ruddock wanted a few people in the gallery just to provide some support for him. So I organised through John to get a man called Sturt Davis Boyd down. So Sturt Boyd is the grandson of a lady called Millie Boyd, one of these Ngarrakwal elders. So they helped get Sturt down there, also with a fella from Save Our Summits Australia organisation, Alan Keane. So they drove down from Queensland. On the way down, just to send a message to the minister, they dropped in at the Breakfast Creek car park in Mount Warning. And to meet them was a fellow by the name of Adrian Hoffman, who's an ex-military guy, and he runs the dental practice on the Gold Coast. When they got there, Adrian had marked out in masking tape against that horrible wall across the track the words, "Tear down this wall." And he and Sturt then gave a wonderful little speech, and Sturt nailed on the wall, reminiscent of Martin Luther nailing, you know, his thesis to that church door in Germany in the 1500s, a couple of demands. And there are only two of them. You know, we weren't looking for the Reformation here, although that might be a good idea. We were looking for just the minister to listen to two things that we wanted to do. So Sturt had two demands. One was to announce a timeline for reopening, and the second one was to tear down the wall, much in the way the Berlin Wall was turned down. So they did a wonderful video, and we put that online on YouTube. You can search my Right to Climb YouTube channel, and you'll find that on there. And they continued down to Sydney, and they met with us outside Parliament House on Thursday morning. Also there was a man called Harry Creamer, and Harry is important to this story too. He is an ex-National Parks employee. He's an ex-anthropologist. So he actually did all the research in the 1970s and 80s and interviewed across New South Wales numerous Aboriginal elders to try and get their stories before they died, to try and get an understanding of where the most sacred sites were, where they didn't want people to go. Harry found across New South Wales, there were only two sites. None of them were at Mount Warning. Mount Warning was significant and special to the Aboriginal people, but there wasn't any call at that stage for the public to be banned from accessing it. So it was never, in his time as an anthropologist with National Parks, there was never a call to ban the public from the park. And he's the guy with the know, right? He's done a very scientific basis for his work. He's actually prepared a number of reports which he sent the minister, which outlined the facts as he saw them. So as I mentioned before, that the claims that are being used to close the park have a very contemporary origin. They're a modern day invention to quote Fletcher Roberts, who used that term in 1999. So Harry was there. We had a few other people as well. So we went into the chamber through the security block there and eventually found our seats in the public gallery at the back of the Legislative Council. We saw John sitting on the chairs there. It was quite an empty chamber. You know, you sort of think that politicians are perhaps going to be doing their job, and when sitting days are on, they're actually going to be sitting in the chamber. There was quite a few empty spaces there. Notably absent was Mark Latham. I guess he's got something better to do than sit in Parliament all day, perhaps, but anyway. He wasn't there. So John, after we had heard a few motions from other members, the debate finally kicked off. So John put forward a motion to have the debate. Penny Sharp agreed to it. And then John got 10 minutes to read out a speech. John's speech was a wonderful speech, very, very factual, hit all those facts that we just sort of talked about the history of the track, about the fact that the claims that are being made are of contemporary origin. He quoted Harry Creamer's report. He talked about the Aboriginal Place Management Plan, how ridiculous it is. You know, it includes crazy, it excludes everyone from the park. It wants to extend the Aboriginal place that's there currently to the entire park and locking out of further areas of that national park to the public. That plan talks about the Aboriginal group having a say in development that can see the mountain. So you're looking at places like Tweed Heads, the Gold Coast, because there's views of the mountain from those areas that this Aboriginal group should have a say in development that affects those views. So this plan was absolutely ridiculous. So John called that out. The next speaker was the Greens, Sue Higginson, and we got from her a woeful... In her view, we shouldn't even have been debating the issue because we've got no right as white people to have a say about these places. So that was a snapshot of what Sue Higginson said. And then the third speaker was Minister Penny Sharp. In John's word, it was basically a load of waffle. So she talked a little bit about the two issues that they had. You know, one, it was a very complicated issue for the government. Very complicated, and she has done a good job, Penny, in terms of speaking to stakeholders, more so than the previous Liberal government. But she spoke about safety being a problem on the mountain still, and also the problem of having to deal with these conflicting Aboriginal views. So we're going to be talking further about it, and she essentially kicked the whole issue down the road. John then got 5 minutes to reply. He did a stinging reply to the Greens member, and basically accused the Minns government of being very soft and woke at the end of it. And that was the debate. Missing were the Liberal National members. We didn't hear a single word from a Liberal or National Party member in the House in support of reopening the mountain. I was really quite disappointed to see that they weren't prepared to stand up and be counted on this issue. So we were left a little bit, you know, disappointed, I guess, and frustrated with the whole thing. In terms of a debate, it really wasn't much of a debate at all, you know. So that's a snapshot of what went on in the chamber.
It's disappointing, isn't it, when the Liberal Nationals aren't there. Mark Latham is no longer with the One Nation Party and acts as an independent in the upper house of the New South Wales Parliament. And he wasn't there either. It makes it really, really difficult to understand why we even bother to go through these processes if these politicians who are meant to work for us aren't doing their jobs, Mark. So, yes, it's disappointing, but did John Ruddick, for example, have anything to say? Was he apologetic or was he disappointed, or did he explain that this is just how the system works?
Oh, no, he was disappointed, particularly with the absence of support from Liberal National members. You know, you can sort of tell you what you're going to get from, you know, the sort of nonsense you're going to get from the Greens. The government was just stalling for more time. Whether they are doing so in the hope that we all go away and they can just bury the issue, we're not going to go away. It's not going to happen. Now, John did an amazing job, and I've got nothing but praise for what he's done for this issue over the last 6 months or so. And it's just the constraints that, unfortunately, we have to work through with this ridiculous parliamentary system we've got, which doesn't, as you say, they're not working for the people anymore. They're working for themselves and their own egos, generally, for the most part. You know, most of the politicians I see in Parliament, why are they there, you know? I'm talking here, obviously, about people like Matt Keane and James Griffin, who were the former environment ministers under the previous Liberal National Government in New South Wales, who said okay to and let this Aboriginal Place Management Plan go through Parliament without any challenge, without it being released to the public for any sort of consultation. You know, they just signed off on it. This is a completely ridiculous thing that they've let through, and now the new government's got to deal with the consequences of that. But you would have thought a Liberal National Government, when they were, you know, in power, would have actually worked for reopening the mountain or keeping it open. But no, they didn't. Yeah,
it is very, very difficult to understand. Now, Penny Sharp says she's the current New South Wales Environment Minister, and she explains to you that it's very, very complicated. This is frustrating in itself. What does she mean by complicated? Is she referring to safety, or is it more of the conflicting Aboriginal views?
In my view, I think she's working out a way where national parks can actually save face for the mess that they've created. You know, how can they get this department through without looking like they're totally cocked up? That's part of it, I think. It's just trying to work a way where people can save face in this, because we've had 20 years of this complete nonsense going through that national parks are promoted. They've actually worked, as I mentioned before, they engaged Southern Cross University to demarket the park. You know, how obscene. At no time has there been any constructive consultation with local businesses who rely on tourists coming for their business. With the bushwalking community, there's been no engagement through pretty much all that time. National parks are pretty much an organisation it's an us and them organisation. We've got our agenda, and we really don't care what you think about, you know, your access in a national park. The issue at the moment, that the other issue that Penny's got on the plate, the big way, is the Brumbies in the Kosciuszko National Park. Again, they're not listening to people on the ground. They're just setting their own agenda and pushing through with it. And it doesn't really matter who the minister is. You know, that's the weird thing about this. It does. This crosses over the party line. It doesn't really matter who's in government anymore. It's the bureaucrats, really, who are running the show.
Yes, indeed. And for those that are trying to make a comparison, this is what we talk about in the US politics under what we call the deep state, that bureaucrats pull the strings. Another example of such a thing would be when a politician stands up during COVID and says, well, we are going to wait for the medical advice and then we will act as what we're told, which basically means that a politician at that point is handing over their decision-making to an unelected bureaucrat, somebody who's Absolutely. Going to do that. And there's the problem, isn't it? Not only do we have what seems to be a lazy parliamentary system and lazy politicians, but this idea that they always refer or defer the decision-making to somebody else in a position of authority. And it's always the same thing. And it's this horrific term that's used in Australia, and it's used in the corporate world. It's now used in politics. I'm just covering my ass. That's the term that people will use. And I was like, hang on a second, you have a job. You asked to be in power to represent. Why won't you just do that for once? Are we all pulling our hair out on all of these issues the same?
There's no responsibility now with elected officials. So they basically abrogate the responsibility down the chain to their bureaucrats. And as you say, COVID was a stunning example. Early in COVID, I just compared the COVID pandemic, this is probably April 2020, to the swine flu pandemic in 2007 or 9, when the Rudd government were in charge. And we had the same dire pronouncements at that stage from health officials. I think the pronouncements were, I wrote an essay for Quadrant on this, around 30,000 people will die with the swine flu. And to her credit at that time, the health minister, Nicola Roxon, actually took ownership of the issue, and she ignored them and said no, because they had a similar plan then for lockdowns, for masks and everything. And she actually took charge of the issue and took responsibility for it and said, no, we're not going to do that. That didn't happen with COVID. It's not happening at Mount Warning and 100 other issues around the state. The bureaucrats have got control. And it doesn't really matter who's in power at the moment. We've got politicians that we elect. You know, we don't elect bureaucrats. We elect these politicians who say they're going to stand up and change the world. And in the end, they just toe the line behind their bureaucrats who are running the place.
It seems like, as you said, them working for themselves here, and to rock the boat gets them out of favour with this bureaucratic push. And therefore, if we can go along to get along, just to sort of explain how this system seems to work, then they can keep their careers going for as long as possible, which makes it just sound like it's just another gravy train. Once you get in there into the halls of power and lawmaking, you elevate yourself in society in this way. And all of it is just, it's revolting to think that this is where we've come in Australia today.
On that, I've met some really good people during this who work for the government, some really good rangers, and when I talk to them privately, they're happy to concede that there are issues with the way they've managed places like Mount Warning and other parks in the state, but they, I guess they lack the spine or the backbone, and they don't want to risk their jobs and their livelihoods to blow the whistle on all this. I'd love for one of those guys to actually just have the courage to release some of the documents that we've been seeking access to, for instance, about correspondence between the government and this Woolloomban Consultative Group, for instance, which are exempt from any sort of FOI legislation. I'd love for some courageous public servant lower down the chain to risk everything and release some of those to the public, or at least, you know, come out with what they actually believe rather than towing the line of the managers who are just part of this corrupt with their snouts in the trough, feeding off the public, you know.
Well, this is something
not going to happen.
This is the hard part, isn't it? And something that we'd all like to see. Now, in a moment, we'll take another break. But what I was hoping to do was to just get your take after the break on some climate change issues, if you will, to be able to provide a perspective and tap in on your expertise. And just quickly, were you able to see pictures from around the world in relation to the solar flare activity? And I was wondering if you even had a thought on what was going on there to create these images.
Oh, I did see some wonderful images online. Yeah, and I did have a thought of going out last night, just seeing what I could see on the horizon here where I live, but we're a little bit too far north, I think, and it was very cloudy last night. So I didn't really see anything outside from some heavy cloud cover. Just a massive solar flare, which charges up our magnetosphere and plays around with those particles that are flying around and produces those beautiful colours that you see as the southern and northern auroras. Absolutely beautiful night skies. They're saying that the sun is moving into a slightly more active phase. So if we get one of another solar flare comes off, we can expect to see sort of similar events. There is a mild risk associated with that, with satellites and telecommunications to be interrupted. Wonderful things to see. Yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously, absolutely spectacular. Some people online who are challenging it and saying it's at a HAARP event that was scheduled between May 8 and 10. That's is part of the reason that we're seeing these images in places that you wouldn't otherwise see the different Borealis events on a normal occasion. That's just another story on the side there. But at the same time, absolutely spectacular. Let's take another break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Mark Hendricks here on Weekends. You're watching and listening to TNT.
I was such a young age. Everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine. Dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'd go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school, hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March, and then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about Canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through, and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador, so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
I didn't ask to be thrown in the streets with nowhere to go, but I did ask for help, and Covenant House was there for me.
1 in 10 young adults will experience a form of homelessness this year. For these kids who didn't ask to be put in this unthinkable situation, Covenant House is there, providing hot meals, a safe place to sleep, medical care, and love.
They just really genuinely just wanted to help me succeed, and I'm succeeding.
To learn more, go to safeplacetosleep.org today.
Weekends are better when you spend it with us. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. And just a quick apology to my colleague, Alex Zaharov-Royat, who on Saturdays follows on my show with his. Yesterday, for the second time almost in as many weeks, I introduced that cinema would be coming up after my Saturday show. But no, cinema is coming up after this show today. So please stay around for that. And again, apologies to Alex for getting it wrong. I love Alex's show, and I immediately after I finish, I sit down and watch his. So I don't know what's wrong with me on Saturdays. Maybe it's a little bit of broadcast fatigue, if we can come up with another term. But we're back here with Mark Hendricks, my guest this hour. Mark, and we are looking at the climate change agenda, and I was hoping to get your perspective on 4 parts per million carbon dioxide and why it is that the world is losing its mind here and politicians just can't seem to resist it.
Oh, God, it's like I got really interested in the climate change stuff back in the around 2005 to 2007-ish. And my position's like a lot of geologists, so, you know, I'm up there with Ian Plimer on this. Every time I step on a rock outcrop, I see the effects of climate change that's happened in the Earth's past some time. And none of that change has been influenced by human activity back in the deep past. I guess you could say, well, humans weren't around at that stage. 400 ppm, it's like, well, so what? You know, there's been times around that the level of CO2 has been much, much greater in our atmosphere, in upwards of 4,000 ppm in the distant past. And oddly enough, we actually had ice ages associated with periods where we did have, you know, thousands of ppm CO2. So the connection between climate and CO2 is really not as solid as you would think. So that was back in 2007. Now I had this crazy idea I could actually change the argument. So I produced a little book called little cartoon book, which was called We're Not Scared Anymore, Mr. Gore. It was a story of a northern schoolroom somewhere in Alaska. And Mr. Gore comes to visit and pops all his facts on the blackboard, and the children basically knock each of them down. You know, so he's talking about this 400 ppm CO2 level, and the kids are pointing out, well, you know, if you look at the ice cores, well, actually temperature change precedes CO2, and it's actually temperature change that's driving CO2 by changes of temperature in the ocean. So as the oceans warm up, they actually expel CO2 to the atmosphere, and a whole host of other facts that Mr. Gore puts on the board. And then in the end, he gets a polar bear, very hungry polar bear, comes into the classroom and chases Mr. Gore off. And unfortunately, the teacher runs out of bullets. And the last scene of the book is Mr. Gore surrounded by a lot of hungry polar bears. Then the other book I wrote, which is another sort of cartoon book, was called The Prince of Precaution. And it's more about risk, and it's more about our perceptions and what we do about managing the risk of these things. And at the moment, we've really got the cart before the horse in this stage, and we've got this mad impulse to control CO2 somehow. It's damaged the West incredibly. We've shrunk our economies, and at the same time, China has gone gangbusters, and there has been no change in emissions. You know, we're working ourselves to the bone with EVs, introducing solar, wind factories all around the country. At the same time, China has made up for all the emissions. So at the end of the day, for all the grief we've put ourselves through, we're in a much worse position now. China is in a much better position than they were 10 years ago. And we're just shooting ourselves in the foot over something that's not really a problem.
Well, this is what many of us are trying to argue, and you're right. I mean, trying to think that you can influence the narrative, you realise just how difficult it is, regardless of how creative you make it. I love the fact that you're able to make a book rebuff Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, yeah. That there was the whiteboard Oscar-winning movie. It's interesting that you've gone down that pathway. Just last night I watched Jerry Seinfeld's film called Unfrosted, which is the story of the Pop-Tart, of all things. Yeah. But the reason I bring that up is that Bill Burr, the comedian, has a cameo where he plays JFK, and it is hilarious because it's in this particular era, obviously in the early 1960s, and they come to the president actually summons the serial people in and tells them off, and then they ask him for his favor, and he says, "Didn't you hear my speech? Ask not." And then they keep asking for things, and he keeps retaliating, "Ask not." But for Bill Burr as a comedian, for those that don't know who Bill Burr is, he's got a bald head, he's incredibly funny, very dry, gets a bit cranky in times, but he was offered this opportunity to be in a film with one of his comedic heroes in Jerry Seinfeld, and he nails it. It has to be the cameo role of the year, Bill Burr as JFK. There you go, Mark. Just something as a bit of an aside, but it's nice that you are using your creative talents to try and explain a story that for many of us are just scratching our heads wondering what is going on here when we talk about this particular trace gas. Now, how do you think, therefore, that we can change anything? If we can, is the process like you've done here, that you followed the formal approach, you went down the pathway like John Ruddock advised to get the e-signatures on the petition and go down that pathway? But even so, you get to Parliament and you're missing one major political party, you're missing perhaps an ally in Mark Latham. Did it make you feel like you wanted to keep going and working and trying that pathway? Or does it say to you, I've got to try now a different avenue to raise awareness to get Mount Warning opened?
That's been raised by a few people just following the debate. You know, where do we go from now? What do we do? What do we do? Do we change our approach? Do we go? Do we become a bit more aggressive with our protest actions? And the next event we've got have got planned is on the 3rd of August at the Breakfast Creek car park at the base of Mount Warning. So what we're going to do is recreate the opening ceremony that was held in 1929. So we're planning on inviting all the locals we can get. We're planning on inviting the Attorney General of New South Wales. So, yeah, 1929, he actually rode to the summit with his wife on horses. So we've got a couple of horses that are going to be showing up for that event. We're going to be dressed in period costume. We're hoping for a lot of media coverage on that. And what we really want to do is just keep the pressure on the government. So we've got them in a position now where they're saying they need more time. But if we don't do anything, then it's likely that they'll just kick it under the table and we'll never hear from it again. So we really need to just keep the pressure on. So I'd encourage everyone who's physically able and they've got, you know, good bushwalking experience to do that summit track, for instance, climb to the summit, take some photos of yourself up there. Let Penny Sharp know that, hey, it's not that much of a safety issue. You know, the track itself is in really good condition considering the events that have happened to it and the lack of maintenance over the last 4 years. There's no chain at the summit rock scramble anymore, but hey, that rock slope is like a spiral staircase almost in its handhold, so it's very easy to do. We had recently a couple of 10-year-olds climb it. So for experienced bushwalkers, there's no real issue. Yeah, mass tourism is probably not on the cards at the moment, but without the track being maintenance being done that it needs, but for experienced bushwalkers, get up there and enjoy that view. There's no reason why you shouldn't. You will risk being fined. So there's a fine for illegal entry up there. The on the spot fine for that's $330. The court fine's upwards of $3,300. At this stage, despite quite a few people climbing up over the last 4 years, there hasn't been a fine that's been issued. So that's in our favour. I think national parks don't want to create the publicity. So we had Ben Fordham, who you might know, offer to pay the first fine for anyone who got fined at Mount Warning. So keep that in mind. If you do get a fine up there, send it to Ben, and Ben will hopefully live up to his word and pay that one. But yeah, look, we're just really looking at keeping the pressure on. So we've got our August event coming up. We will be climbing again on Australia Day 2025. There will be other climbs that will be going on. I've been speaking with the Chamber of Commerce up there, so we want to get a business roundtable just to get a statement from the local business community to say how much damage has been done. Maybe they can send an invoice to the government. At the moment, the costs are upwards of $54 million for the four-year closure. I'm sure the government getting a bill for something like that, maybe that'll keep the issue on the table and hopefully put the pressure on Penny Sharp to reopen the mountain for everyone.
It's a great plan that you've got there, and a little bit of civil disobedience seems to go a long way, and you've got the blessing at least of mainstream media in terms of Ben Fordham, who also has been in the news this week again in terms of the Snowy Mountains and cloud seeding. He's decided to go take that mainstream. Did you happen to catch that, and what's your thoughts on the cloud seeding in the Snowy?
I saw a snippet of it, so I'm not that over that part of the issue. I was more interested in his call, I think, the week before about what's happening with the Snowy Hydro Project, you know, the tunnelling machine being bogged down again. And the timeline for opening what's supposed to be our life-saving battery that's going to save the lights in Sydney being pushed further and further into the 2030s. You know, I don't think it's ever going to open, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that these green policies and plans and grand plans to change everything just get pushed back? It's one disaster setback, cost increases one after the other. And you do wonder what's the straw that breaks the camel's back that will be when the net zero plans, et cetera, get pushed back one after the other. It seems that every other day there's another disaster with electric vehicles, another disaster with batteries, another car explodes, another bus burns, something like that. Do you think that the public may well be the driving force here? Well, obviously you do, because that's what your plans are for Mount Warning. But it seems that this is the approach now. There's enough of an irritant that's going to get people walking with their feet, literally, as it turns to Mount Warning, but also on other environmental issues.
Yeah, I think the key is with the public to that silent majority really needs to find their voice on these issues and hammer home to their local representatives how unacceptable this is. So in terms of the energy situation, you know, energy prices are going through the roof as more and more of this so-called renewable stuff comes online, and it's not renewable, it's not green either. It's devastating the environment. You've got solar factories and wind farms around the place, the bird choppers. doing huge amounts of damage. The raw materials that feed that coming from mines in Africa and other places, all those, and no emissions are being changed because they're are saved because they're all coming from China now. What I think what's going to really hit home is when we hit, you know, this rocketing inflation and that keeps going off. You know, the price of food, the price of goods, once people find it really hard to start to afford stuff, I think you will see the silent majority getting angrier and angrier. And we also need, I think, people to get away from the two major parties. You know, in Australia, we've got a party of the extreme left in the Greens, we've got a party of the left in the Labor Party, and we've got a party of the centre-left in terms of the Liberal National Party. We've got one right-wing party, or one centre-right party in One Nation. I would say put your faith in a change. You know, we had a massive revolution in our governance, and a big vote for One Nation, and the Libertarian Party, for instance, will get that through.
It's interesting, isn't it, that one has to be able to walk with their feet, and the silent majority needs to perhaps open their mouth a little bit more. You made a comment earlier in the hour about joy, and this is something that's really been bothering me for some time, because it seems that the reason that national parks were created, and in the United States, we talked about in the last show, many people considered that national parks was America's greatest ever invention. But now we live in a world that everything is just about misery and inequity and struggle and injustice all the time. And the blame is always, you know, laid upon the white man, the middle-aged white man. Goodness me, it's got to that particular stage. I feel like here in Australia, we haven't had much to enjoy. Our politicians don't even seem to care about it. It's just a race to the bottom in terms of how we can make more fear, more disaster, etc. And so it is that the work that you're doing to try and create awareness in Mount Warning, you've gone the other way. You've gone completely to create this wonderful, joyous occasion on the 3rd of August. Clearly, you must be seeing things similarly. Why are we so anti-fun anymore in this country?
Good question. You know, throughout that whole COVID period, you were told to be safe. Just keep safe. We want you to be safe. If you look at National Parks Facebook ads or any of their ads that they put out, the marketing's all about stay safe in our national parks. And you know what? I really don't want to be safe. I want to have a good time. And I know the risks, and adults know the risks. And what we've got are government bureaucrats basically making decisions for us like they're our parents or something like that. And we need to get away from that. We need to take responsibility for our own lives again. You know, part of this is, you know, built on, you know, if you look at what the Libertarian Party stands for, it's about personal responsibility, personal freedom. And people need to be more willing to take that on and to stand up for what their, you know, for their personal rights, their personal freedoms, and at the same time take responsibility for their actions. So, you know, if we want that joy at Mount Warning at the moment, we've got to be prepared to jump across that gate and do something illegal. But, you know, if we don't do that, then that's going to be lost for everyone, and especially our grandkids and kids, you know. And that's the sad thing, because we're training up our next generation to live in this sort of insulated, protected, cushion-like world where nothing bad's ever going to happen to them. You know, it's just this complete denial of reality, and we need to get away from that and start living our lives, you know, on our own terms again.
Yeah, exactly. When you look at a term like safety in a national park, I mean, it's painted as a picture that, you know, someone's going to fall off a cliff and there's no net at the bottom and therefore they're going to die. But realistically, anything can be determined safety. Walking on a track, for example, and slipping or tripping on a rock and rolling an ankle or catching a branch of a tree or a twig and scratching a leg and getting a little bit of a graze, that would be considered to be unsafe. And this is the point, isn't it? So there's got to be some relative approach here from politicians to go, okay, and like the Libertarians are saying, personal responsibility. Can we bring that back, please? The idea that common sense is not common anymore, that the idea of OH&S replaced common sense. You know, it was one thing if you saw a hole in the ground, you walked around it. Now, instead, modern society says, well, no, we're going to put a fence around it. We're going to wear yellow high-vis clothing and we're going to make rules and have policemen there to fine us. It seems that that's how far we've come from common sense to safety today, Mark. We've got about a minute left.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's called zero harm. So it's a zero harm mentality, and it's creeping all the way through society. So we will make a society for you where, you know, if you stay in your lounge, if you follow all the rules, nothing bad will happen to you. And that's that myth that's being promulgated. At the same time, hey, you may not have a very happy life. You know, you may not even have a very enjoyable life, but you'll be safe. And that's the sort of lounge chair view of the world that the bureaucrats love, and the government is this. Governments around the world are only too willing to not stand up for it.
Yeah, absolutely, and it makes us all nihilistic. We just sort of give up and don't really care what goes on, and we just jump from hoop to hoop, fear to fear, and that's absolutely no way to live. Well, Mark Kendricks, you've done the opposite. You are teaching us how to live again by becoming politically active and working out new ways to convince politicians that they don't control our lives. We are grateful, and thank you for your time today, Mark.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks again.
Wonderful. Well, we'll keep in touch, and of course we will look forward to the 3rd of August. It's going to be a wonderful event up there at Mount Warning. Now, that concludes today's show. It concludes Weekends for me this weekend. After the break, cinema. That's right, cinema is Sundays. Alex is on Saturdays. Apologies again to Alex, but thanks everyone. I think we had a wonderful, wonderful show with some amazing guests. Bruce Fremong, Victor Davis Hanson, Barry Nussbaum and Mark Kendricks. I'm going to go. I'll see you next week. You've been watching and listening to Weekends. You're on TNT.